again, and welcome to our latest podcast. We're very privileged today to have as our guest Dr. William Bengston. Dr. Bengston was the guest at our last ICRL meetup, and his presentation was greeted with great acclaim by the participants, so we're really glad to have a chance to let the rest of you learn a little bit about what he's been doing. So, Bill, thank you for joining us. And
Pleasure.
It's good to have you aboard. Bill, why don't we start right out talking a little bit about this anomalous healing that you've been exploring for some years now.
Well, I got into this about 125 years ago when I ran into a psychic, or somebody who claimed he was a psychic, and I was reasonably good in designing research studies, and I decided to put together a research program that would make his effects all go away. And I failed. I couldn't make it stop. My life became more complicated over time when he morphed without a teacher into a healer. And when he was doing readings, he started to do, I guess, what would be called in parapsychology psychometry. And people were claiming, as he was doing readings on them, that their physical symptoms were leaving.
Now, psychometry is when you hold something that belongs to another person and you kind of pick up information about the owner of that object?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, token object reading, that kind of thing, yeah. And so he started to do that, and both of us, I tried to make that effect go away too and failed, but it started to get connected to the relief of physical symptoms, which was curious to both of us. I don't naturally default to belief. He actually, curiously, didn't default to belief. So he liked having me around because I would keep trying to make the stuff go away and would keep coming at this from a skeptical point of view. And shortening the story a little bit, it turns out that I had had a bad back, a chronic back problem for years. I'd actually even given up a swimming scholarship because of it. I was a butterflyer, and after about 100 meters, I couldn't arch. And so I was in chronic pain most of the time, and eventually I came to my senses and I said, you know, come on, guy, fix me. And he said, how? And I said, essentially, shut up and do it. And I leaned over a kitchen table, and he said, what do I do? I said, I don't know. Put your hands on my back and make it stop. So he did, and it did.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and both of us, I'm sitting there going, you know, what the hell? And I haven't had a back pain since, which is pretty interesting. So I became curious, and he obviously was very curious. And again, he had no teacher. So we started, I started talking him into putting his hands on all sorts of folks and to see what would happen. And some things responded pretty quickly and some things not so quickly. One of the things that was pretty interesting to me was that benign tumors almost didn't respond at all. And malignant tumors responded immediately and dramatically.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and I was curious, and it's a clue. I'm not sure yet how to unravel it, but it's a clue to something. I watched a couple hundred people get treated, and this is going to sound cynical, but I really don't mean it this way. After a few hundred people, you don't learn much.
I know that feeling.
Yeah.
I felt that way after our first million bits.
Yeah, I would think so. So, you know, they come in, they do their stuff, and the random number generator does this or does that, and you know the plot. And what are you going to do after that? Well, I had the same thing with people that okay, you come in and you put your hands on, you do whatever it is that you're doing, and some people, things are responding, and some people not so much. But my problem was I didn't know what to do even with the people who got better.
Mm-hmm.
So in my case, my back got better. I mean, there's no question, you know, from my subjective point of view, I'm pain-free ever since. I know I had the bad back. I know I don't have it now. But if I came and I told this story, and it's only a story, if I told this story, you would be left with belief or not belief.
Yeah, there's a big difference between an experience and the description of the experience.
Yeah, and the experience to anyone who has it is pretty powerful, obviously. But if I were listening to someone tell me the same thing I had experienced, it'd be like the fish story.
Well, and the first thing you'd say is, can you replicate it?
Of course. And so, you know, they say, yeah, I used to have a bad back, and I'd be thinking to myself, yeah, whatever. And so we had some pretty interesting cases where we had x-rays or scans or blood tests or whatever, and it was clearly the case something was going on. But even then, so let's say someone comes in with X, and you do hands-on stuff for however many times you do it, and let's say X goes away. Well, I still don't know what did it.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you a quick question. When you do this process, or when your mentor does, do you see the same pattern of the types of things that are affected, or the kinds of symptoms that perhaps don't respond? Does he have the same experience as you do?
Yeah, and that's actually pretty curious to me. I don't have any proprietary information, so I have any technique that I've ever used, it's public. It's either in print or it's in audio. I don't have any secrets. So for better or for worse, this is what I do and this is what I found. And the interesting thing, I've also done a whole number of workshops in this and trained people to do it, and they're finding the same patterns. And I have a standard joke, but it's not really a joke. So I say that benign tumors don't seem to respond. Malignant tumors respond. One of the things that no one has been able to do, and I swear this is literally true, is a wart.
That's curious. Aren't those the ones that are famous to be susceptible to hypnosis?
Any schmuck can fix a wart, except this one. Me. I can't do it. In fact, anyone who uses my techniques, if I say this to a group of people who are somewhat familiar with healing, they say, come on, you know, nobody can't do a wart. You can just say boo and it goes away. You can hypnotize it. You can suggest it. And then I'll hear 100 different wart stories about how any schmuck can do a wart. But this one can't. And so I say, okay, do my technique and go out and do a wart. And they go, come on, it's the easiest thing. It's not even interesting. I say, try it anyway. And they try it anyway. They can't do it.
That is really fascinating.
So there's a clue here, you know?
You don't have any nasty wart stories in your deep, dark past, do you?
No, not at all. But I've had in my cancer experiments, I've had volunteers, and I always work with non-believers, inexperienced people. I've used undergraduates, I've used faculty members and such, and I've actually had students do some experiments of mine who have warts, you know, or they'll have a little teeny wart. If you're 20 and you're a female, I don't mean to be sexist, you think the wart is 5 miles wide and everybody's staring at your wart. And I say, if you can do my experiment, I'll fix your wart. And of course, that turns out to be a lie, because I have no effect on the wart, and I end up offering to pay for the dermatologist to slice it off.
Marvelous. But how did you get from that to mice?
Well, a few hundred people are interesting. A few thousand aren't. Because you come in, again, with that famous algebraic disease called X, and you leave without it, and I'm oversimplifying the process here, was it the hands-on? Was it suggestion? Was it grapefruit? Was it you started to exercise? Was it, again, I'm a skeptic. And so I don't have the head, apparently, or the disposition to try to unravel clinical cases.
And what percentage of the people that you treat show a response?
Well, it depends on the condition. So in the case...
Except warts.
Except for warts, because that's the big W. And if it's benign, very few. If it's malignant, everybody.
Everybody.
Everybody. And this, too, is oversimplification, because there are confounding variables where you can undermine this. And that is, we found that if a person is taking some sort of therapy which is meant to kill cells, then it seems to interfere with this stuff. And without being facetious, I don't know that healing and killing ought to be combined.
Well, that makes perfectly good sense when you think about it.
Yeah, if you're going to kill, kill and go for it. So I haven't tested this experimentally yet. It's on the drawing boards, but I haven't done it. And my suspicion is if you, for example, radiate mice and then treat the mice, I don't think that the effect will be there.
That has interesting implications for the treatment of cancer across the board, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. My guess, and I say this not as a medical person, that I'm hoping we look back on 2014 someday and go, my God, what were we thinking?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we do the exact opposite thing of what we ought to do. If someone has a compromised immune system, and because of that, cancer starts to spread, the last thing you want to do is a therapy that undermines the immune system.
Well, of course, if you go at it in, you know, the standard way of approaching a cancer is to go to war with it, to defeat it. It's the enemy. And you come at it with a negative approach. We're going to kill this thing.
Yeah, and that's curious to me.
And yet, in a strange way, one might contemplate the fact that a cancer cell in your body is a cell of your body that's just gotten a little confused.
Yeah.
And maybe you don't want to try to kill it, but maybe give it a little therapy. Yeah. Tell it you love it. I'm being facetious, of course, but not totally.
I don't think that's facetious. I agree with you completely. I suspect that healing is driven by the healee and is driven by the needs of the healee. So if you've got, I mean, I don't know that anyone's ever been found who doesn't have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And this is done on 20-year-olds who die suddenly in car accidents and things. If you really look at it, everybody's got cancer. But just as your body is taking care of a bunch of stuff all the time, I think your body is also getting rid of things it doesn't want, or it's converting it back to something else.
But, you know, one could consider also a cancer cell is a cell that doesn't respond. It doesn't know where it fits into your body. Immune system doesn't recognize it as part of yourself.
Yeah, I think it's deaf.
Yeah.
Blind.
It's got an identity problem, and to welcome it back into the system lovingly, it certainly isn't going to be any worse than trying to kill it with radiation.
I couldn't possibly agree more.
Okay, so here we are. How did you get onto mice?
Well, again, you do a couple hundred people, and people are interesting and annoying. My current mission is to save all the rodents, and the hell with the people. People who have chronic conditions have a tendency, and this is my editorial, to become that disease.
Hmm.
And so you go through life managing your condition.
Yeah, it defines you, actually.
Yeah, and then some crazy person comes along and does something nutty, and the condition begins to leave. This is analogous, I think, to forced retirement. So, you know, thank you and good night. So I, for example, I did a person as a favor to someone who for 20 years was completely incapacitated by very, very advanced depression. And she couldn't function, and basically didn't go out of the house, didn't really get out of bed, didn't do anything. And her sister was a clinical psychologist and asked me to do this as a favor. But this person really hadn't been out of the house in 20 years. And so her identity was, I don't know that you could even meaningfully say she had an identity anymore, but suddenly some loser comes along and starts doing this crazy stuff, and the depression starts to lift. Well, if you haven't been out of the house in 20 years, you're going to go through some trauma, because now you have responsibility. Now you're a person. Now you're a very different kind of scenario. And it turns out that may be an extreme case, but a lot of people have a similar reaction. If they have a life-threatening thing that is going to take them imminently, that's a little bit different. But even there, people go squirrely on you. The healing stuff has been intermingled somehow with, I don't know, faith. And I don't have any, so I mean, I don't think that helps at all. But it's a faith-based thing, and then you can see you're a stone's throw from making it some sort of religious doctrine, and you're a stone's throw from making it, I don't know, people make it all complicated. I just think it's a natural thing.
In a strange sort of way, it makes me think, I can't even think of the exact statement, but in Buddhism, There's a statement that translates to "Thou art not that."
Oh, okay. Yep.
And I think I'm right. I could be wrong on that. But in a sense, the message that the healer gives to the patient who has identified with his or her disease is the message of "Thou art not that."
Yeah.
And then you go through an identity crisis.
That's a tough message to take in.
Yeah, and if you're really attached to your disease, you're going to hold on to it. But on the other hand, if you're willing to listen, you know, the reaction would be, oh, good point.
Yeah.
And then you open up and you can let it go.
Yeah. That's a beautiful sentiment, hard to put into practice.
Yeah.
Well, and I've seen angry. The most common response to a healing in my experience is anger.
Uh-huh.
And that just flabbergasts me. People get angry all the time. And then
yes.
I have several problems with doing clinical work in this stuff because you have anger. You have a huge file drawer problem because people come and I watch this, you know, way back with my mentor and he does something. And when I say healing, I'm not talking about magic here. There's a process and it's a pretty interesting one. And it's actually a pretty difficult problem to try to unravel. But let's say you start getting better and then you get scared or you get angry, you get whatever you are and you run away. Well, what happens to that person? And the answer, of course, is I don't know.
Yeah, I had a conversation with a physician once who surprised me by pointing out that when he has a patient come into his office, the first thing he asks them is, do you want to get better?
That's, yeah.
And he said, you would be surprised how many people have to think twice and they, well, I don't know, you know?
Yeah, so, long pause.
Well, that brings me around back to my question. But now you've given the answer. Why would you want to deal with mice? But given humans, I think mice would probably be much more agreeable.
Not even close. Not even close. Yeah. So people get angry. They run away. I get a file drawer problem. And then I have the compounding problem of they get better. Well, why? Was it me? Was it time? You can look at problems in healing on a number of levels. For example, pain. Let's take pain. Well, pain for many, many conditions cycles. It goes up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And you're most likely to go to someone when you're at the peak pain period.
Right.
And then you do whatever procedure you are, and let's say the pain diminishes. Well,
right.
Skeptical me would ask, was that time? Was that the cycle? Was that, you know, so you have a pain, you go to whatever therapist you have, conventional or unconventional, and then a couple of days later, the pain's less. Well, if I were the therapist, I'd be extremely skeptical that had anything to do with what I did.
But you're not the therapist.
Yeah, that's right.
Most of them are quite convinced that it was them.
Yeah, so, you know, I go feeling lousy. I go to a psychologist. I say, I'm feeling lousy, and I go through, you know, the old Woody Allen joke. You give it one more year, then you go to Lourdes. But you... So I go through therapy for all these months, and then after a few months, I start to feel a little better. Well, did the therapy have anything to do with anything? I'm a skeptic.
Yeah. But if the information that's being transmitted to the patient is this message of you are not the disease, that message can get through to the body, even if the head isn't accepting it.
I think that's possible, yeah. I do. But in the grand scheme, I've got this skeptical me spinning counter hypotheses all the time. What else it could have been, including nothing more than time. I mean, if you've got a stage four end stage something, you know, that's a little different, but that's not every condition. What do I make of this? And then people are taking, you know, other medications or not taking, and I don't know how to unravel all that stuff. And so skeptical me said, I can't keep doing this. We need an ironclad test that can factor out anything having to do with faith, factor out anything that has to do with extraneous variables. And a friend of mine who was at the time at City University at Queens College was in a position to set up a bio lab. And he said, we can do something. And we talked about it for quite a while. And we came on a model wherein cancerous mice, who are very, very widely studied, a particular model of mouse that's very widely studied. You know exactly what's going to happen to them. You know the mice, you know the cancer, you know what happens after the mice get cancer, you know how many cells to give the mice. And there are literally 10,000 published papers on these mice. And the particular mouse model that we settled on at first came out of a working biolab. Their day job was working on this particular mouse model. And they said with great assurance that the longest living mouse in this particular model, it was a mammary cancer, lived only 27 days after you inject it with a certain number of cells. It's 100% death. So they all die between 14 and 27 days after injection. The standard deviation of death is 3 days. And it's an extraordinarily tight, normal curve looking model with 100% death after 27 days.
Well, isn't that what they say? The only thing that's sure is death and taxes?
Yeah. Well, the mice not only were dying in 27 days, but they were also not paying taxes. So we decided to get revenge on them. And so we set this up, did the healing technique on these mice. Presumably they were non-believers. And we treated them in a bio lab under the supervision of a biologist who was already working on this particular model and had 20 years experience with it. To give you an idea how skeptical I am, I thought the thing was failing and tried to call it off. And at the time, I was thinking of healing as something as an analog to radiation.
Mm-hmm. Killing that, it.
Yeah, so if I go, you know, what we were talking about before, I go, you know, zap, zap. So if we got to the mice early after they were injected, the healing would do something like kill the cells and they would never develop tumors and all of this. I mean, we were all making this stuff up. We didn't know what we were doing. So we got the mice 3 days after they had been injected, and we start treating them, and they start to grow tumors. And I said, well, you know, let's be constrained by the data here. It's not working. Mm-hmm. And I got talked into going on a couple extra days, and I, you know, fighting all the time, going, this doesn't, why are we doing this? You know, the tumors are growing. It didn't work. You know, let's move on. I got talked into a couple more days. And the mice then growing large tumors, clearly not getting radiation from me, they started to develop these blackened areas on the tumors. And I was really sure that they were dying. And then the tumors started to ulcerate. And you had these large tumors developing these monstrous ulcerations. And I'm jumping up and down going, folks, let's call this off. Why bother doing this to mice? And biologists pointed out that, you know, they're acting as if they're healthy. And I said, but they're not healthy. Look at them. You know, they're ugly. And they got these big growths and they're ulcerating things and all that. And said, but the eyes are clear. The coat's clear. Everything's clear. Do it a couple more days. And the short version is the tumor imploded into itself and the mice were cured. And cured, I mean, as distinct from remitted, they were cured. And we can say that because they were cured for life.
What do you mean for life?
We kept them 2 years waiting for something to happen. And they lived out their normal lifespan, happy as a mouse. After a few months, I gave them little wheels to play on and things like that, put them into a fish tank and on and on. And we kept them for their entire lifespan. And further, when in subsequent experiments, we re-injected them with cancer. And it turns out not only were they cured, they're cured for life. And they can't be given cancer again.
My goodness. So they have developed an immunity to the cancer. And
yeah.
That's
yeah.
Fantastic. Well, what happened to your control mice?
Well, the control mice, this also turns out to be layered anomalies. The control mice in a different building, we hear a control mouse died, then we hear another control mouse died, then we hear another control mouse died, and they're all dying on schedule. Nobody's reporting anything odd there. In our first experiment, we said, you know, we can't take this anymore. It's going to kill me, the curiosity. I said, I got to go look at the control mice. So we broke protocol, and I went over to the control mice and took a look at them, and they were this little, pretty pathetic, huddled mass of mice just kind of huddled together, barely breathing. This was nothing like I had been experiencing with the treated mice. I came out of there. I was in there for no more than 10 minutes just looking at them going, oh, my God, this is ugly. No blackened area, no ulcerations, just they were dying as they're supposed to be dying. So some had already died and died according to the patterns of this cancer. And these mice were obviously just about to follow. And I, after spending no more than 10 minutes with them, a couple of days later, a graduate student came running in and said, something's happening to the mice. They're developing blackened areas on them. And then they ulcerated and then they imploded and those were cured too.
Now, you didn't touch them when you were there, I presume. You just looked at them?
I never touch any mice. It's just, they're just in the cage and you can sit there and put your hands around the cage. Yeah. We don't actually touch the mice. I mean, every once in a while you touch their nose because they're trying to sniff through the little top of the cage. Yeah. But we don't hold them in any, nothing like that. Yeah. So we had full cure and we had the controls once seen also got a full cure. That was pretty scary.
The control mice got a full cure.
They went to full cure once we saw them. And this set up a pattern that we've done at least a dozen times. It's a pretty interesting phenomenon. Yeah, I think that one of the faith-based assumptions we have in traditional science is that separateness, physical separateness, means independence. Uh-huh. And I think that in my experiments, it's reasonably certain at this point that that's not necessarily something you ought to bet the ranch on.
Well, in a sense, aren't all of the mice in this breed or species of whatever it is, in a sense, they're all clones, aren't they?
Essentially, yeah. They're close you're going to get to clones, yeah.
So it may be that they have some kind of collective mouse and consciousness.
Well, yeah, and you can go Sheldrake and talk about the fields and what happens to one will affect like and all that, and I don't diminish that. But in my experiments, in order to get the controls to die, and that sounds stupid, but in order to get them to die, they have to be in a different building. And if they're in a different building and no one who knows the technique sees them, they'll die on schedule. And we've done this now a number of times, and volunteer healers, and I'm using healers loosely because they don't consider themselves healers, volunteer healers, when their curiosity gets to the better of them and they go sneak in and they find out and they go hunting down where the control mice might be, if they see the control mice, at that point they become bonded to the group and they'll go through the pattern of cure. If they don't see them, they'll die on schedule.
It reminds me of a study I heard about many years ago. I think it was with rabbits, where it turned out that the control group tended to be doing better than the treatment group, which confused the researcher, until the researcher found out that there was a lab technician that was petting the control rabbits.
Ah, oh, wonderful, wonderful.
So they were being touched and paid attention to.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be doing more for them than the medical treatment.
Well, I know that Bernard Grad at McGill University, and he's the granddaddy of all healing research, Grad did some studies and he called it gentling.
Gentling. That's a nice word.
Yeah. So we just kind of take our little finger and we kind of stroke the mouse and mammals respond to that.
Hey, so do humans.
Oh, yeah. So, well, some humans are mammals, not all of them, but some humans are mammals too, yeah. And we like it. And so there have been, I know at least Grad did studies on what he called gentling, but I don't know how widespread the literature is. It's pretty interesting.
Well, where are you going now? What's the next step?
Well, I have a dozen mice experiments, actually more. And right now I'm searching for a model that will not be related to mice and easier to do. So I've got mammary cancers, sarcomas, oncogenic mice, and I can just keep going, a different stuff that I've tried in all sorts of different labs, and I do in labs across the country. It's hard to do mice research because, first of all, it's ugly.
I don't know, Bill, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have this image of you being on your way to a new experiment and all the little mice are saying, Dr. B is coming. Dr. B is coming.
Yeah. But I also get hate mail from him because I give him cancer, you know. So it goes both ways.
This is true.
Yeah. But it's ugly research, you know. These are sentient beings, and you're doing nasty things to them. So you got to have some ethical quandaries going on. And I needed to do it in order to get what I've gotten. But I also have many, 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 many experiments on the drawing board, but I can't do them at 2 years at a pop.
Sure.
And so I need to run through some pretty quick iterations of experiments in order to find out what works and what doesn't. So, for example, let's say you even want to find out, here's a question. Can healing be taught?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is certainly the case that virtually everybody who does healing has been taught.
Yeah.
But the question is, what teaches you what? So you do whatever technique, and you do the technique, and at the end of the technique, you seem to be able to produce some sort of anomalous healing. Well, it's pretty hard to figure out if it was the technique.
Right.
We don't do any pretests. You wouldn't even think of doing pretests. So let's say the group of people come to my workshop, and they take the workshop, and then they leave, and then they go out and they do, you know, wonderful things. Well, who's to say, frankly, and again, I speak as a perpetual skeptic, who's to say that they couldn't have done it anyway? And I just gave them permission.
That makes a lot of sense.
Because I'm the only person nutty enough to try this stuff. I was speaking to an internist friend of mine, and he was asking me about my techniques and what do you do and how do you do it and all this. And I said, well, here's the first technique, but I don't know what this does. And here's the second, I don't know what this. And he said, what's the difference? It works.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just stared at each other for a long time. And then finally I broke the silence by saying, you're an idiot. You care about whether the patients get better, and that's it. And he goes, yeah. And I said, I care about what does what.
There was a study in the area of radionics some years ago. Some guy had developed some kind of a box that, I don't know, it had leads coming out, and they would, the short form was that this people who were interacting with this box in whatever way were getting healed. And some skeptical scientist came along and said, well, you know, this is fine, but I want to see what's in the box. And he takes the box apart and it's empty.
Yeah. Yeah. That could have been a Tiller thing. Yeah, that I don't know in this particular case if it was Tiller, but his idea of conditioned space and all that. And there's nothing in there. That you just put the box in there, and you put intent in the box. Even the basic question, can healing be taught? It's pretty interesting. Yeah. I couldn't find anybody who actually ever raised the question. So I published an article with a biologist buddy of mine, Don Murphy. I think it's in Explore, Larry Dossey's journal.
Yeah.
Where I raised the question, we raised the question, can healing be taught? And people got really upset with that. I've had pretty well-known people come up to me and say, that was a stupid paper. And I said, well, that's fine. Can you tell me where I went wrong? Well, no, it's just stupid to ask the question. I said, well, does my argument or do my data not make sense? They say, well, I didn't read it.
I've heard that before too.
Yeah, they said, well, I don't need to read. They said, I don't need to read it. And I said,
yeah.
And you think I'm the idiot?
Yeah. Oh yes, oh yes.
I said I'm fine being wrong, but show me where I am wrong, and you know, by all means, I'd be most appreciative. Mm-hmm. So the mice take too long to do, and I'm looking for, in particular, if possible, something simpler that comes right back at you. So I'm doing some cell culture studies right now. I did some at Wake Forest Med School. I'm doing some at Brown Med School. I got a bunch of them going on. I've done some at UC San Diego Med School, and we're getting some interesting data. If I can get a nice, simple, reliable cell culture study that you can get an answer to in a day, then I can start to go through and start to parse out what might be doing what.
Now, are you using cancer cells or healthy cells?
Well, I'm doing both. So I have, I give you a pretty interesting result. We tried treating the medium, the nutrients in which cells are grown, And then you just put the cancer cells into that medium. I mean, they need something for nourishment and life and all that.
Right.
And so you hold the nutrients bottle for a while, and then you never see the cells, but you just ship it off. And then cancer cells are grown. And what we have is, to give you one result, a 600% increase in the growth of cancer.
Increase,
yeah. And I was pretty happy about this because it was one of the very few hypotheses I ever got right. I usually get things wrong because I don't know what the hell I'm saying, but I conceptualize healing as coming from the healee. And the question is, what do you need?
So if the healee is a cancer cell.
Yeah, cancer.
It's going to get happy and it's going to reproduce.
Cancer loves to reproduce. And so what we have is it might be more than 600, I'm trying to be conservative, but about a 600% increase in the growth rate of cancer.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to do statistics on it. It'd be absurd. So obviously something happens. Now, what I want to do is take this energized cancer and put it into a mouse. And what I think will happen, I mean, what are the odds of me getting it right twice? But what I think will happen is that the cancer will then collapse because it will go to the higher order need of the organism.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Well, Brenda, if you think I'm making sense, then you could be in trouble.
Well, we all know I'm nuts. Now, this is absolutely fascinating stuff, Bill. Now, I know that in the past when you've been asked, well, what is it you do?
Yeah.
Your typical answer is, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I remember being approached by someone many years ago when we were working at Pear, and this woman asked me, well, what is it you do? And I responded to her, I don't do, I be.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you might respond to?
I sometimes act as, I'm using healer loosely, as the healer. I mean, I'm not a healer. I can barely spell healer.
It's with an A, not two E's, Bill.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Let me write that down. And although the other makes more sense, right?
Yeah, and the skeptic would say so.
Yeah. So what I do is I get inexperienced skeptical volunteers, and skeptic I mean in the real sense of skepticism. I don't mean this as believers in things don't work. Most people are believers of one sort or another. And if you believe in the reality of what I'm saying, then you believe it. If you know that I'm completely out to lunch and the restaurant's closed, you're not a skeptic, you're a believer.
So basically you're looking for agnostics. I know the people who say, I don't know.
I want a blank slate,
mm-hmm.
not someone who's trying to defend a belief system.
You have to start with two-year-olds for that.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. I go through quite a bit of sign-up process because in one experiment, what you had to do was audibly laugh in my face. Something like that. Yeah. And say, no, really, what do you want me to do? And I said, no, that's really it. And they say, no, come on. And they think I'm doing a study in gullibility. And so I want these blank slates without beliefs to defend who reasonably would be skeptical in the real sense of the word skeptic and who will do exactly what I say to do. And so I've had faculty volunteer and students volunteer and I've volunteered and it depends. But what we do is a series of techniques which are completely faith-free. One of them is a technique of very, very rapid imaging. And I have this in writing, and I'm not doing this as a sales technique, but I have this in writing, published in journals. There have been accompanying articles on how to do it. I also have a CD set that it's a drill in practice on how to do it. But it's something, it's not a technique where you're going to learn it in 10 minutes.
Right.
It's not simple. The people who learn it from me, I think without question, or without exception, at one point or another, must be cursing me out. Like, how did I get into this nonsense? But it involves some pretty interesting drill and practice of very, very rapid mental imaging.
What kind of imaging would you?
Well, it starts out with you're making images which are idiosyncratic to you, and they're very, very concrete about things that you want. So they have to be specific. Yeah, you ask people, what do you want? And everybody in any group, any place gives me the same three things, all of which are nonsensical. I want to be happy. And I go, what the hell does that mean?
Right. You know, I want to be rich.
I want to be, yeah, so you know, and I want to be healthy. And there's, I've never found a group that doesn't say the same three things. So I don't even ask people what they want anymore.
Well, that's our educational system.
Yeah, so I say, get that out of your system. So what does that mean to be happy? You know, so well, does it mean I have an apple? You know, then it's, you want an apple. It's, I need a new car? Well, then it's a new car that I want. I want money. You know, why? So I can get a car. Well, it's the car that you want. Uh-huh. And I want to be healthy. Well, are you already healthy? Well, then you already have what you want. If you can't walk, well, an image might be of you walking.
Or, now, when you do this imaging, this is things that the healer wants, not necessarily that I want the mouse to get healed.
That's right. So I'll give you an image that I use in my experiments. So let's say I have a half dozen people who are going to be volunteer healers. Again, they have no experience. And they're going to make out their lists. And they'll be their own list with their own things and the stuff that they want. Very concrete, without regard to when or how. So it's only what's. Mm-hmm. And an image that I almost never ask anyone to put an image on their list because it's their list. But one of the images I have is of us toasting each other in my living room. Mm-hmm. Now that has nothing to do with cancer and has nothing to do with mice.
Yeah.
It's simply, and it's also not even a dictation of what the data are going to be. It's we've had a successful experiment. And what does a successful experiment mean? Well, it means that we did everything right. We got some really cool data and we're scratching our heads trying to figure out what it means. And in the case of cancer, and if you got mice, the mice no longer have cancer. So you don't focus on the cancer. It's the next step. It's past.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always past. So
you're sort of visualizing an event in the future after the goal of the experiment has been achieved.
Yeah, it's already done. And how it happened and when it happened isn't any of your business. So let's say you got bad knees, you can't walk. Well, the image could be you doing moguls, which of course would give you bad knees. Or you playing tennis, or you. It's got to be the thing that you want to do that you can't now do. It's not fear-based. It's future-based.
So does this work in a sense like, you know, time reversed causality, where events in the future determine things that preceded them?
Well, you're taking me down a metaphysical road that I think I'm very sympathetic to.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, because I'm almost always wrong. So it's the sensation I have is, let's say you, and the list is supposed to be at least 20 things. You're not wishful thinking anything. And you go through these images very, very, very rapidly. So rapidly that if I described how rapidly, you'd never believe me. I have and this is obviously speculation, I got a hunch that the images, in effect, put out a future address from which you are teleologically pulled.
Yeah. You know, that's consistent with our colleagues in Rome, Antonella Vanini and Ulisse De Corpo, who they did a podcast with us, I guess it was last year or even the year before. But they have been exploring this model they call syntropy.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a balance or a complement to the law of entropy. In the one hand, the law of entropy goes from past to future and becomes more and more chaotic. Syntropy is a force that goes from future to present and becomes more and more coherent.
Yeah, I would be very, very, very sympathetic towards that.
Yeah.
Very sympathetic towards that. So, but the future that you're going towards, I think of it as kind of like a collective address. So in One thing that's happening is we're toasting in my living room, and the other thing that's happening is I'm driving in my new car. The other thing that's happening is the other thing. And stuff starts to happen, and you start moving in that direction. It's kind of weird.
It does work, weird or not.
Yeah.
And of course, how people will say, well, have you got an explanatory model? But you really can't have an explanatory model for something that is inconsistent with anything that we know.
That's right.
I used to talk to 10-year-olds who visited us at the laboratory years ago. And I used to try to explain how one went about trying to make a model of this stuff. And I'd say, you know, it's just like when you build a model of an airplane. You know, you have a box with a picture on the cover, and you got all these pieces, and you got a sheet of instructions of, you know, how to fit this piece with that piece. And this is the same thing. The only thing is there isn't a picture on the cover. You don't get the instructions, and you don't have all the pieces.
Yep.
But otherwise, that's basically how you build a model.
I think so, yeah. And I'm very, very, very sympathetic to these ideas. Yeah, so these are hunches that a number of people working in independent areas are starting to come together, you know, and think in these terms. It's a pretty interesting problem. I've done a whole lot of tests what happens when you do this technique. So I've looked for physiological correlates. I've looked for mental correlates. I've looked for, you name it, I probably looked for it. I've
done this
also with others. So I take, for example, here's a paper published in JSE. When you do the cycling technique, you get a very, very, very anomalous, now I'll just loosely call it signal in the brain.
Hmm.
And I work with some pretty heavy-duty EEG experts, and they all tell me that this has never been seen. Now what that
don't
means...
Don't you love having people say that?
Yeah. So what that means, I don't know, other than they'll say, I'm aware of 500,000 EEGs. This does not exist in those 500,000 EEGs. But the interesting thing is that you can almost toggle it on or off by turning on and off this cycling technique. And the more equally interesting phenomenon is, in addition to the anomalous wave, which again is in JSE, is that if I think about you, the wave will appear in your head. And so we have simultaneous phase locking of brains at a distance.
Hmm.
Now that's pretty interesting.
It is indeed.
And this is a completely faith-free process.
Now, Bill, when you do this imaging, is it strictly a, you know, visualizing thing, or do you express or generate an emotional feeling to go with it?
Well, the imaging actually occurs so quickly, again, you'd never believe me, but so quickly that you can't get a visual. It's going on in the same way that we go through life. We have mastered a task, and then it recedes to background.
So it's almost like a slideshow.
Much, much, much faster than a slideshow. Think slideshow on serious steroids.
Well, I could see how that would take a lot of practice.
Yeah.
As I listen to you, I realize that's not that easy to do. It sounds easy.
Yeah, and it's a pain. It's really a pain. When you first learned how to walk, you kept going thump, and then after a while, there was a phase transition, and suddenly it became unable to imagine not being able to walk.
So what has happened to you now that you've mastered this? Do you go around with this very fast slideshow going through your head all the time?
Yeah, pretty much. So there's no time in this conversation that I haven't been doing it.
And it
is completely receded to the background in the way that you and I could walk down the street and we'd be focused on each other and we can walk, talk, chew gum, and gesture at the same time. This has transitioned for me from a mindful exercise that took a lot of practice to a mindless thing, in the analogous way that driving a car or walking down the street is mindless. Mindless is always superior to mindful.
Yeah, this is awesome. In a sense, what you've done is you've replaced the random noise in your mind that we all go through all the time with a more ordered, structured pattern.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree.
So usually when people start learning to meditate, It's very hard to keep from distracting thoughts here and there and everywhere. But as you develop a technique of meditation, you can quiet that noise and be able to focus. And now we could go one step further and say what you're saying is you not only quiet it, but you replace it with this cosmic slideshow.
Yeah, going very, very fast. And among the interesting things is, depending on how fast you go, is there are recognizable patterns in EEGs for meditators. There are similar patterns that develop in the cycling technique, even though you're going essentially in the opposite direction. So the meditation tries to quiet down. I'm overwhelming with this slideshow on steroids, and you're getting a relaxed response in the brain. And then there's other anomalies that appear, but that's slightly a separate issue. But you can get to this altered state, if you will, by going slower or faster. And then when you go even faster than that, when the steroids are on steroids, then you get this anomalous pattern, which I can then reproduce in you.
Okay.
And so you're not aware of it because, I mean, we're not aware of almost anything we do. If I were, for example, to change your heart rate, which we've also demonstrated, you probably wouldn't be aware of it. So you go from 70 to 72 beats a minute. Well, you're not going to notice that unless you're really tuned into your own heart. And we're less tuned to our own brains. But I can reproduce that effect in people at a distance and put brains into phase lock.
Now, did you develop this technique before or during your experiments with healing? Was this something that you had developed earlier before you got into the healing game?
Well, it really came down to give the short version. This crazy guy who rudely could do this stuff and even more rudely fix me, he also had a tendency to respond to questions and he wouldn't understand what he was saying. Really getting down to the essence, I would ask him questions like, can anyone do what you do? You know, what's going on here? And how, and if they can, and that would be the answer, what is it that you would need to do? And so, giving you a lot of shortcuts, the question was, is there anything that people could do to reproduce what you're doing?
Uh-huh.
And these techniques are the outcome of that.
And how long did it take you to master them till they became unconscious, till you could walk without falling?
I'm not a good one because I'm the co-developer of the techniques, so I'm not the good marker. But the folks who I teach now to do this, it takes a bunch of hours. I'll just leave it that vague, that it takes a bunch of hours. And I'm going out, for example, to California. I was there last October, and I taught a group of people, and they're doing amazing things. And I'm going back out there to give them a little boost and to find out what's going on. But they get together and they practice, and they, you know, they curse me out from a distance. But it's going to take you at least weeks.
Well, it's a lot easier than climbing up into a mountaintop and staying there for 20 years.
Yeah, that's right.
It's all relative.
There's people out there claiming magic and all this kind of thing. And I, you know, go ahead, because that's better than me. I don't have any magic tricks. I got this annoying thing that takes a while to master, but it produces some interesting results.
It works. Listen, we are starting to get very low on time. I could listen to you talking about this stuff all day, but I'm not sure our listeners are going to want to stay plugged in that long. But
yeah, probably
not. If they want more information, we might point out that you do have a book called The Energy Cure that's available, you know, online sources and so forth, and a CD set called Hands on Healing, the training course in The Energy Cure. I might also mention that Bill is, in one of his other hats, is the president of the Society for Scientific Exploration, which publishes the Journal of Scientific Exploration, and also puts out a magazine called The Explorer. There are a number of papers in the Journal of Scientific Exploration that can be downloaded if you want to read more about this work in more detail. The website is scientificexploration, one word, scientificexploration.org. Okay, scientificexploration.org. And then you click on the journal, and there's an archive of back journals, and you can look through them and access a few of Bill's papers. I mean, this work is fascinating, and each time I speak to you, Bill, it gets more fascinating and triggers more thoughts and associations in my already scattered mind. And I just love it. I think this may be some of the most important work going on in modern science. It is what we've referred to as a science of the subjective.
Yes. Yeah.
This is a science that incorporates the subjective, the mind, as part of the process instead of trying to exclude it. And it's fantastic stuff. I love what you're doing. Please keep it up. And when I start doing my visualization, I'm going to envision you, you know, giving high fives and having all of your experiments succeeding and lots of funding to pursue
it. Lots of funding. That would be good.
We'll work on that.
Right. Yeah.
But Bill, thank you so very much for joining us and giving us of your very busy time. As always, it's just a sheer joy to chat with you, and hope we'll be able to do it again.
Absolutely. And thank you very much. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.